episode 51 of AT12 Productions presents the television crossover universe on the Grand Canal Network. Coming to you live from behind the chrome microphone of excellence, we have me, James Boyachuk, CEO of 18th Wall Productions. We do not have Ben Kasson, my fellow CEO of Dubois, because we like those really complicated last names and words, because currently he decided, rather than spend time with you lovely folks, he is just going to be sick today. Please send all of your hate mail direct line to him.
Get well soon, Ben. Since some of us have some sympathy. Hi, guys, it's M.H. Norse.
No. We have two M.H.'s this week.
Well, can I introduce myself?
No, you cannot, because you are part of this growing whatever on the show, because now the M.H.'s have doubled. We don't have just one. It's no longer just M.H. Norris, Mystery Maven, and Sci-Fi Sorceress. Now it is also... Yes. And now it is also the other famous M.H. of this show, Micah S. Harris. Author, Disney show expert, film historian, college professor, and award winner.
Moral of the story, James is doomed this hour. Wahahaha.
So, how are you, Micah? Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me again. I was glad to be here.
Yes. And, of course, everyone at home, as always, the TVCU crew are a team of crossoverists who devote way too much of their time, 51 hours and counting, to connecting the dots through official crossovers and Easter eggs, all in order to demonstrate a shared fictional reality that we call the television crossover universe. Now, as always, what plugs, shameful or shameless or otherwise, do we have today? Would you like to start, Micah?
My article on the unmade sword and sorcery movie of the early 80s, Thongor and the Valley of Demons, is finally out. It was a delay at the printers due to a little thing called the election. They actually got it off its scheduled release date, but I'm hoping that it should definitely be available off of the Little Shop of Horrors website, and I would imagine, coming into comic book shops and so on very soon, if not already on the way. So that's something that's been about 6 years in coming or more. So it's finally, it's good to finally see it come to fruition. So that is my my current shameful or shameless plug.
And what would you like to pitch to everyone listening?
Well, I'm going to pitch like a doting mother. Actually, this past week, when you guys get to the recording, we had the anniversary of Doctor Who, and the Time Travel Nexus did a phenomenal job. My entire Doctor Who team of writers, we all came together, we covered all the anniversaries, and I think all the articles were well written, well done, and truly celebrate everything that's great about
Who. Would you like to talk about your Doctor Who writing team, what they all cover briefly? Give them a bit of a pitch and a boost.
All right, let's
rag
see.
On them.
Let's
if
see.
If you even remember all their names.
It's actually one last name I'm sitting here actually mentally going over.
Probably mine.
No, yours, I'm one of the three people on the planet that I can actually spell his last name. But we're going to start with Tina DeLucia.
Given how many times I misspell my own name, you might be one of two.
I really might. Tina Marie DeLucia kicked off our day on last Wednesday, with a write-up of An Unearthly Child. And Tina is known as the queen of the black and white era. And
yes,
did a magnificent job at writing up and telling the story of not only An Unearthly Child. In fact, the plot was barely touched upon. More the focus was on the episode and the struggles and how almost completely and totally screwed Doctor Who was, not even barely out of the gate good. From there, we went to me, and I covered The Five Doctors.
The 20th anniversary special.
I was getting there. You just like to cut me off. First was the thing with K-9 last time, and then there's this.
It is my favorite pastime, but continue.
But we covered that. I, once again, barely touched on the plot. I think I ragged a little bit on what Liz Sladen was wearing. Bless you, Sarah Jane, but that was an awful outfit. You could have given me something a little easier to cosplay sometime. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
No, that one, if I ever actually do it, it's going to be fun. I talked a little bit about The Return of Susan. a bit about the infamous bubble wrap dress that Zoe wears in that episode.
Yes.
And how, for Elihu, earlier this month, I actually, with the help of some people, recreated the dress and wore it for one of the days of the convention. And Fraser Hines, who played Jamie, absolutely adored it. And whenever he ran into me, his hand would be on my sleeve popping bubbles all day. It was a beautiful thing. Then we went... Then it was two James, actually. I actually had to, like, go on my fingers and count these. Then it was James who covered the Dole 25th, the Silver Nemesis and Remembrance of the Daleks, one that should have been the 25th and one that actually was the 25th anniversary special.
Yes.
So he covered his bases and did both. And it was actually a really fun write-up. I thought you did an excellent job.
Especially with the defense of Silver Nemesis, which I think is really unjustifiably hated.
I think it's a fun episode. I've seen it several times.
It's the weakest Ace episode, but it nowhere deserves the degree of hate it gets.
No, I mean, it's not, but it's fun. From there, we went to another one of our new writers on the Nexus.
Rassilon Pennington, his pen name.
Thank you. Really? Is that his pen name?
That's what we're talking him into.
Sorry.
His real name, however.
William Martin. This is a proof that we record this thing live. By some of our reactions, who covered the 35th anniversary of the Infinity Doctors, a book, actually.
Lance Parkin.
Thank you, because I actually don't remember the author. Sorry.
I knew you didn't, that's why.
He's actually going to be coming on the Nexus once a month or so and giving us a book review, which covers all of our bases now with Doctor Who coverage. I'm really excited. But he came and did a fun review. I know, James, you had some... thoughts about it.
I did, and you can find my thoughts in the comment section. All the more reason to check out William Martin's article.
Yes, because James provides commentary in the comment section. From there, actually, James was just making a Will sandwich on Wednesday because he was on both sides because you came back with 45.
There's a quote that's going to haunt Will.
Sorry, Will. He came back with 45, a surprise post that I found hiding out when I was going to approve posts for Doctor Who Day. Covering the 45th anniversary special from Big Finish 45.
Yes, and how it was supposed to star David Tennant, but that fell through at the last moment, which kind of crimped Big Finish's plans.
But it's still fun, and it's actually one I have listened to. I say that because even though I feel like I've listened to a lot, I really haven't. But I'm getting there. But it was a fun review, and he actually does like highlight and talk about how that was supposed to be Tennant, but ended up not being, and it's fun.
And now I will briefly brag on you, and the day closed with Mary Helen Norris's look at The Day of the Doctor, an in-depth look at why it was a pretty good episode on its own right, but as an anniversary was a miserable, insulting failure that failed to live up to the hopes of either classic Who fans or new Who fans. It's really a pretty nice write-up.
I can't take complete credit. I have to give some to Tina, because... there was a PowerPoint made, and thoughts came from there, and discussion that was had from a bunch of people at LA Who, and it really actually got me thinking about the Day of the Doctor and kind of made me sit down and actually make a more objective look at it. And I mentioned briefly, you can go look at more, like I talk about one of my highlights is actually just the appearance of David Tennant, who I absolutely adore. And
yet, he's not even written in character.
No, he's written as David Tennant, but unless you're like me, and you sit there and kind of obsessively study both, the 10th Doctor and David Tennant, you might not catch that difference, because they're so similar, but it's there.
Yes. And I believe that's where the day ends.
That's where the day ended. And then, on Friday, we actually gave you a bonus post with James's Big Finish Friday, covering one of my absolute favorite audio dramas, Light at the End. It's Big Finish is 50th, and to me is the true 50th, that or the Five-ish Doctors reboot.
Which, sadly, no one did a write-up for, but look for it next year.
Yes, that's on my list next year.
And unless Micah, MH, either of the MH Squared group, do you have anything else to pitch?
You didn't pitch anything, but no, I'm good.
We went a bit long on Doctor Who, and you talked about a lot of things I've been involved in, so I feel satiated with my plugging.
All right. Well, then, if that's all for this part, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with some fun with the MH Squad and, I guess, James.
Micah S. Harris is a guest, really, that needs no introduction. He's been on so many times with such great looks at all of the things he has going on that really there's nothing left to say. Yes, he is an award-winning author. Yes, he won the 2016 Pulp Arc New Pulp Award, something I can now say without stumbling over it.
Took you long enough.
Took me long enough. For his novel. Now, this I'm going to stumble over because it's a bit of a mouthful. Ravenwood, Steps on a Mystery, Return of the Dugpa. A very well-deserved award. He's done multiple other novels, multiple other short stories from a variety of fantastic publishers. He is one of the busiest people in New Pulp who keeps up a consistent high level of quality. I've said it all about him in the past, but today, you've mentioned this a few times before, but today he takes on a new hat. Film historian. And he chronicles the tale of one of those lost movies that never quite made it to reality. Now, this article is Lost in Lemuria, Milton Sabosky and Harley Koklis, Unmade Thongor in the Valley of Demons.
I feel better now because I was sitting there reading that last name. I'm like,
It's worse than mine.
I was like, I needed a phonetic spelling or something.
Now, Micah, could you tell us more about your article? What's it about? Your movie and the article, and where can our listeners find it?
Yeah. Well, I first read about this movie back when I was 17 years old in the late 1970s. And at the time, I was very keen into stop motion animation. I was doing my own with my Super 8 camera, and of course, you know, one of those young guys that worshipped Ray Harryhausen and Jim Danforth and Willis O'Brien. And I came across an article in the magazine Starlog, which was a very big deal at the time when there were no or very few comic book stores, you know, let alone any specialty bookshops related to the science fiction and fantasy genre.
Starlog really is impressive looking back, and I'm kind of sorry I missed it because they really did run the best in-depth behind the scenes interviews.
Well, yeah, it was a big deal to when Walden Books set aside like a corner of their section of their shops to science fiction and fantasy and Hildebrandt brother calendars and things like that. But of course, you know, the information was hard to come by, much more than it is today, especially for someone living in Wayne County, North Carolina. And so I read about this movie that was coming out. They had a two-page article on it, which mostly was given to a plot synopsis. But it did have some interesting photos of the animation model, what would have been one of the animation models they were going to use. And so I went out and read the first two books in the Thongor series, because this was going to be based on the works of Lynn Carter, who is, I guess, somewhat famous or a little bit infamous. Lynn Carter is really one of the most important people in the modern popularity of fantasy and horror.
Absolutely.
As an editor. Yeah, as an editor, he was bringing things into print that had been out of print, I believe, for some time. He was, you know, really pushing to get people exposed to the old masters, and who would rather be obscure authors, perhaps some of them, if he had not been pushing for the I believe they call it the adult fantasy line.
Yeah, the Ballantine adult fantasy line.
Right, and. So yeah, he did that to which the modern fandom owes him a debt, and most people don't even realize it. He's a bit controversial though in that, along with L. Sprague de Camp, he was one of the rewriters of Conan the Barbarian's adventures.
Oh, yes.
When Conan came back into print in the 60s with those great Frazetta covers. Those stories were rewritten somewhat by DeCamp. I don't know how much Lynn Carter actually put into the rewrites, but he, you know, he
actually, I do have an answer on that.
Okay, great.
DeCamp did more of the rewrites of the Conan stories, the adaptions, the expansions, and so on, while Lynn Carter mostly looked them over. But Carter was more responsible for the ones that took, say, Borak stories, or Solomon Kane stories, or Eric the Red stories, if I'm not completely messing. No, that's a Haggard character.
That's an X-Men.
Excuse me. I'm there. Yes, but... Yeah. He was the one responsible for taking all of these other Howard heroes and then adapting their stories into Conan tales. So that's sort of how they divided the work, from based on my understanding.
Well, another thing they would do, or at least Carter did once, and I think more than once, was to take plot ideas for his Thongor character and turn those into Conan stories.
Oh, yes.
And I get into this in my article briefly, is that one of the weird twists in the story of Thongor making it or not making it to the big screen is that one of the episodes in the Schwarzenegger-Conan movie is actually based on a Thongor story that Carter rewrote as a Conan story. And it's just a little snippet of the actual tale, but it's the scene in the Schwarzenegger Conan movie where he gets his sword down there in the crypt or the tomb. And that turns out to be, I believe, the only actual narrative episode other than the crucifixion of Conan, which came from Howard's A Witch Shall Be Born, that actually made it into the Conan movie. And one of those was supposed to be Thongor. So for just a few seconds there, you can almost, you know, squint your eyes and believe that you are seeing Thongor up there on the big screen, portrayed by Arnold Schwarzenegger. But but anyway, Carter was, like I said, that's one of the controversial things about him. But again, a very important figure, ultimately, if now obscure. But he wrote himself. He himself was an author, and, you know, he was perhaps the pure pasticher, or at least attempted to be. And that, you know, the idea is that his writing didn't really have any personality or vitality or snap to it of his own, which in a
Very
sense
true.
Was what he was trying to achieve. He was trying to achieve, you know, summoning up the authors. He was pastiching. And so I know that G.K. Chesterton said that, that a artist should be judged not by what he should have done, but what did he mean to do and did he do it? And by that standard, Lynn Carter is a screaming success as far as it goes.
That is true.
Yeah, maybe
he
didn't
did have a remarkable capability for losing his own style in Lester Dent, Edgar Rice Burroughs.
And I don't know if he ever how much of his own style he actually had that existed.
I mean, reading his Anton Zarnak stories is probably the closest thing to the true quote unquote Lynn Carter style, and it is the most bland, hard to get through. I am writing words. There is no style sort of tale.
Right. Well, it's just I understand that some of his Doc Savage pastiche character.
Yes.
Prince something or whatever.
Prince Arkham. Nemesis of
okay,
Evil.
So that was actually supposed to be kind of interesting. That he was actually there starting to do a bit of a Philip Jose Farmer kind of thing. But
they're
I've never
very unusual. You should pick them up. They're interesting enough, especially since you can get most of the series for pennies on the dollar. Anyway, I believe you had a question to ask, MH.
Yes. Well, someone special did the art for this article. Can you tell us a bit about that?
The start of the article?
The art in the article.
Oh, the art in the article. Oh, okay.
Yes.
Wow, yeah, it comes from various places. There is a great Bruce Timm Inside Front Cover that full color that's done, that is illustrating, you know, real accompanying my article, even though, you know, my article doesn't show up till well into the issue. But that is Bruce Timm's rendition of Thongor and the Princess Sumaya, who is Thongor's Deja Thoris. Yep. And Tim, of course, is a very well-known animator, one of the brains behind the 1990s Batman the Animated Series that I think some people think is the best Batman has ever been done. And so it was just a real thrill to get him to do that. I was hoping, you know, for just a black-and-white spot illustration. And then I asked the publisher, you know, I said, well, see if he'll do a full-page color. You know, I mean, what does it hurt to ask? Yeah. And he asked, and sure enough, Bruce Timm was interested in doing it. And I know he has an interest in that kind of material, you know, from his own art. And from a short Conan story he did way back when Dark Horse had it, at least initially. He did a beautiful story, beautifully, just a little short thing, but, you know, beautifully done. And interestingly, speaking about Lynn Carter as a writer, Bruce Timm had, was going to sit down and read, you know, the Thongor books, I guess, before he drew. And then just said he couldn't do it. They were written so poorly, he said he couldn't make it through it. So, you know, and that's true. Again, you know, Carter's pro style. My favorite thing that Lynn Carter wrote is where he said something along the lines of, he phrased it as, "She lifted her proud head proudly." That made it into print, you know, like, holy cow. But anyway, fortunately,
well, I mean,
for
every
me,
time something like that makes it into print,
they just didn't
a
have
bad
a James.
Writer gets their ring, gets their wings.
I was going to say, they just didn't have James, because he doesn't let me get away with that kind of stuff.
That's
but
why
the
you
thing
should be
about
nice
it
to
for me, yeah, I was fortunate that when I read the first couple of Thongor books, I was a teenager. My critical faculties had not really developed, and I enjoyed them. You know, I mean, they were fun. They were enjoyable reads for me. I'm glad I didn't have things tripping me up, because I, you know, obviously they made something of an impression on me. But you were asking me how the article came to be, and I did not hear anything about it for forever after that Starlog article, and things were coming out about it, but I didn't have access to that information. It wasn't always easy to get a copy of magazines like a Cine Fantastique. That's you know, it was a really high quality magazine. It went to a lot more in depth material than Starlog. So I didn't know, and then so finally I decided I'm going to find out. And by this time, like three decades have passed, and we have the internet. And so I was able to start hunting people down to quench my knowledge and or quench my desire for knowledge, and I did. Started about 6 or 7 years ago.
Okay, that goes part of the way towards answering one of my questions, which is, how were you able to get in contact with everyone? You managed to find ear or email typing fingers, at least, of some very impressive people. How do you make friends and influence people?
Well, you know, I would that it were so. I think I'm just, one thing is that, you know, I'm very fortunate that people have taken pity on me. I went to...
pity is the grand motivator.
Yeah. The first person I got in touch with was a guy named Tony McVie, or Anthony McVie. He's still active in the special effects business. I don't know how I found him. Like I said, it's been several years. I don't know how I found his email address, but he was the guy who was mentioned and quoted in that Starlog article who was sculpting that animation model. And so I was able to get in touch with him, and he turned out just to be super nice. And at the time that I show you how far this goes back, when I first initiated contact with him, he was working on the Jim Carrey A Christmas Carol, you know, which wouldn't be wouldn't be released until the following December. And so he was working on that, and he's just really nice. And so he was the one that started me, you know, going. And I found the agents of Harley Koeklis, who lives in England, his agency. And I got in touch with him through them initially. And, you know, I just, I would send queries out, and these people were just really nice. And, you know, it's been some time since the events happened, but they were, you know, good to pass on what they could remember. Jim Danforth, the twice Academy Award nominated special effects man, who was an important piece of the Thongor film saga, I was able to get through him through a man named Neil Pettigrew, who put together the Encyclopedia of Stop Motion Animation. And Neil was kind enough to forward, you know, my queries to Jim Danforth, who was then nice enough to answer them back. There's a picture of Jim Danforth in the article. And also, one of the things that turned up at the very end, practically, was that the publisher, I guess, you know, mentioned to another writer or whatever, he became aware of what we were coming out with, and he was like, yeah, you know, I own a pre-production painting by Jim Danforth for that Thongor movie. Yeah, you want to use it?
Oh.
So, sure enough, yeah, we've got a painting of Danforth dead of a ship, one of the, in Thongor's world, there are these flying airships, one of them flying over this, you know, landscape.
That's fantastic.
So that, you know, that worked out very well, and that was, you know, something that came up toward the end. So, you know, then Tony McVie again got me in touch with a gentleman named Anthony Pratt, who turns out to be Boris Karloff's, like, nephew. It's like he's his third great nephew or something. Huh. Yeah. And I didn't know that for forever, but I knew he had done set design for Excalibur, and then another John Boardman film, Zardoz, which we were talking about, or you were talking about comics briefly. You know, there is a Superman villain, right? That's based on Sean Connery's looking Zardoz. Yes.
Of all villains to base it on.
So, but I don't know that Pratt had anything to do with that. And then he volunteered to get me in touch with the director, whom I've been trying. I've been sending emails to, and lengthy emails, two or three, and I wasn't getting anywhere, hardly. And then Mr. Pratt, you know, kindly just did mention, well, I'll stay in touch with the director. And next thing I knew, I had an email in my queue from the director, Harley Koeklis. And
very nice.
So I was able to interview him from there, yeah.
Okay. If this movie had been made, what would its impact have been? For instance, this is a stop-motion, heavy, very 1970s-style fantasy movie. What do you think its impact would have been, and how do you think it would have fared in a post-Star Wars world?
That's a good question, because the way they were going, they were, you know, lining up to come out in almost the immediate wake of Star Wars or The Empire Strikes Back. The way that Milton Sobotsky talked about the film and how he wanted to, you know, develop it was very much in the spirit of what George Lucas did in the first Star Wars movie, you know, which was a lot of action, you know, a lot of action, things moving, exciting things happening, colorful things happening, larger than life things, you know, going on. And so it was very much in the spirit of the Star Wars, first Star Wars movie. Sabotsky was really very forward-thinking at this time. Even before Star Wars, he was thinking about what today we would call a franchise with Thongor, or a series, you know, for the next 10 years. And at that point, no one knew if the, you know, the next Star Wars movie was going to continue or kill the Star Wars experience. But Sabotsky was already thinking that way. You know, in terms of what kind of impact would have it had, I think a lot of that would have depended on the cast. Thongor, as written, you know, is not that exciting a guy. You know, he's sort of out of central casting, as they say, for a barbarian. And, of course, you know, this is what Carter was striving for, you know, if you want to call it that. But that's what he was going for. But I've seen, you know, like in some of the recent Marvel movies, how the right actor, Cumberbatch, is that his last name?
Yes.
The new Doctor Strange? Yeah.
Yes.
Right. You know, how he has made, you know, Doctor Strange, Stephen Strange, so much more interesting and fun than he ever was in a comic book. Robert Downey Jr. did the same thing with Tony Stark, you know, livened him up. And so if you'd had the right actor, that would have helped. But I think what would have hurt it more than anything, and, you know, somewhat frustratingly, this was one of the people I was did not get in touch with. There were two things, you know, given that Milton Sabotsky had passed away a long time ago, that I wish I could have had for my article information. One was to see a copy of the script, you know, and be able to read that. And the other was to talk to the guy who was going to be taking over the stop motion after Jim Danforth. Now, with Jim Danforth, you know, it would have been excellent. But the gentleman's name was Barry Leaf, and the animation he was familiar with was children's program and animation, you know, like Paddington Bear kind of stuff or whatever, or Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer over here in the States, you know. And I don't know that he was really in a good place to have pulled off, you know, what they needed to do. And in the article you can read that one of the special effects related guys says as much. And so it also sort of came out through one of the gentlemen who gave us some information who was there. He wasn't working on Thongor. That had been why he was hired to work with the Milton Sabotsky Sword and Sorcery Productions. But he ended up, you know, developing, working on some development for another stop-motion movie they were going to do called King Crab. Are you familiar with King Crab? Apparently it's a series of books of science fiction novels. You ever heard of King Crab?
No. No, I don't believe so.
Yeah. No. Well, anyway, Alan Friswell is his name. He's a wealth of knowledge. He had sent in, wrote him a letter when he found out about Thongor and was wanting to work on it. And they got back in touch with him and said yes, but he actually never did much really with Thongor or anything with Thongor at all. But he was working on King Crab, but he was around the studio at that time, you know. And he said that he felt that Sabotsky was really pretty naive about what he was getting into. That he wasn't as, you know, he wasn't really prepared as he should have been.
Yes, that and, very much seemed the case.
Yeah, he, you know, it was so, you know, if it had gone off with Jim Danforth in it, with it, even if it had not been the hit Sabotsky wanted to be, you know, it would still be popular today among, you know, special effects and animation fans. To see, you know, all that Jim Danforth animation. There's not really an awful lot out there. But to see that film, you know, it may have some fondness for me. You know, people, you know, even get fond over what that movie, Jared Sin, Metal Storm or something, or you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Metaphor, you know, these kind of 80s movies
yeah.
that,
yeah.
And, you know, like, you know, Sinbad and I and the Tiger, I mean, they get picked up by TBS and shown repeatedly. No, Clash of the Titans. That's the one I'm thinking about, Clash of the Titans. So, yeah. I think that if Danforth had stayed on it, then there would be really no reason that it should not have been at least as popular as Clash of the Titans, which, you know, comes out post-Star Wars, is stop motion. And, you know, and of course, so interestingly, it's the last film Ray Harryhausen did. But at that time, if it had come out with Danforth, I think it might have did okay. And would have its fans to this day. They had a good budget. Which sounds minuscule to us in our day and time, $7.5 million. But George Lucas brought the first Star Wars in at just like $4 million, you know, and Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger was even lower. So that was an excellent budget to have at that time to be making a stop motion animation movie. If he had known about what I consider the third generation of stop motion animators, people like Dave Allen, Phil Tippett, those folks, then you know he would have probably had a better chance in producing something in terms of the special effects, you know, in terms of quality. But how Barry Leaf would have turned out, you know, nobody knows. But I do feel that doing, you know, kid animation with puppets and all that, probably not as complex as trying to convey a sense of a living creature, you know, that is interacting with people in a shared, you know, shared space and time. And, you know, getting that sense of life and all that larger than life element too. I don't know that he would have been prepared, but I would have loved to have spoken to him. I don't know if he's still alive or not, but I, you know, I tried to get in touch with him, but with no luck. So
one last question about Bangor, and then we're going to jump into Frequency of Fear.
Okay,
so,
great.
Briefly, Subotsky had a very interesting set of influences. He worked on the Peter Cushing Doctor Who movies, which really seemed to be a perfect example of his storytelling sensibilities, as little dialogue as possible, streamline, action, and idolized George Pal. He seemed to particularly idolize the earlier fantasy-heavy George Pal. So, not really a question, but feel free to comment on that. I thought that was interesting enough to bring up.
Well, yes, apparently Subotsky was in love with the idea of paring, you know, dialogue down to almost nothing. In one article, he was, you know, talk about how proud he was that in the Joan Collins adapt character, you know, still in practically no one knew who Joan Collins was pre-Dynasty. But she is in the adaptation of All Through the House, the E.C. horror story, and that's Subotsky's Tales from the Crypt, where they took these certain E.C. stories, developed them, and this is the one where you had the serial killer dressed as Santa Claus going around, and then he starts trying to get in Joan Collins' house, and she's battling to keep him out, and then finally her little girl lets him in, saying, "Oh, Mama, Santa Claus is here." So that was an episode that he said, you know, got down. If I remember this correctly, that episode got down to really no dialogue, and he was very pleased with it. He mentioned a longer story of the Skull that they had adapted from the Robert Bloch story, starring Peter Cushing as a collector of occult items. The Skull is the Skull of the Marquis de Sade. And he talked about how, you know, the end of it went on for a long time with no dialogue. And so that was kind of his dream thing, you know, to get something moving like that with very little dialogue. He felt that characterization scenes and love scenes and all this sort of thing got in the way of the story. And so, you know, the unfolding plot. Those type of things, you know, typically need dialogue. And so he wasn't interested in that. So, yeah, he wanted to trim that out. That was part of, again, his aesthetic, his sense of action moving forward, the story moving forward at all times. That's sort of what you get. And what was the second part of that statement? Said there was something else other than his...
just about that. How much he idolized George Pal.
Oh, George Pal, yeah. He apparently, you know, according to this one mention in a Starburst article I referenced, you know, seemed to like the comparison with George Pal, and the idea that the Pal, you know, like himself, he could relate to Pal because he said Pal had all these great ideas but had trouble getting money, you know, to realize them. But Subotsky, at that period, I think he was really wanting to have a major career change, not out of the movie business, but in the kinds of movies he made. You know, he was wanting to have more family-friendly fantasies, you know, type stories that would be, you know, come under the umbrella of, you know, for the whole family. And he felt that Pal had done that successfully, and of course Pal, I guess, had. Although Pal's movies do have talking in them. They do have love stories in them. Yet, you know, Pal, wholesome entertainer, lots of stop motion, or at least he was no stranger to stop motion animation. And you look at a movie like The Seven Faces of Dr. Lau, based on the Charles Dumont story. And The Seven Faces of Dr. Lau is just a most incredible movie. And one, again, that didn't do well at the box office. But it's got a lot going on in it. What it has to say about life and living, and very positive and upbeat. And it's not that Subotsky had been, you know, doing porn before that or anything like that. You mentioned the Doctor Who movies. You know, those are very much aimed at children. The Peter Cushing Doctor Who, of course, has nothing to do with Gallifrey. Of course, nobody knew anything about Gallifrey at that point, I don't think, in Doctor Who's history. It was so early when the Daleks caught on and were such a hit. But, you know, Doctor Who's just a, you know, a funny old man scientist, you know, tinkering with his TARDIS and, you know, going through time and then encountering the Daleks. And a big treat, you know, for audiences back in the early 60s was to see a Dalek in color. And, you know, and I think they had them, you know, painted the different colors and played that up and that excitement.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, so that's good, you know, family stuff, wholesome stuff. And even the things he did, like the anthology movies, like I was talking about the one, the Joan Collins episode from Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror, you know, he had restraint in those stories. One that I was particularly fond of, one of those movies that I was really fond of as a kid, was Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. And, you know, I could see that movie as a kid and get scared and weirded out, but it was also, it was fun, you know, fun stuff. And so I think that, you know, he was really wanting to turn that way even more so than the movies he had been making. What was really fueling it was the breaking up of Amicus Productions, which Amicus, ironically, means friends or friendly or something in Latin, and that's not how they ended with he and his partner. And so he broke away and started Sword and Sorcery Productions. But again, you know, I think he was wanting to be more of the kind of filmmaker that Powell was, that he wanted to give something, you know, wholesome and clean. And which, yeah. Ironic, the irony there, too, is that George Pal was turning to make a racy movie at that time. Yeah, George Pal is going to be doing a film, The Disappearance, which I guess is a known science fiction novel. And so that's kind of a bit of a twist there.
Okay, in our final moments, we're going to move into talking about the frequency of fear, and we may need to pick it up in the next episode. We'll see how things go. But your short story, Frequency of Fear, really expands upon your use of Dugpas and all of your mythology you've introduced in Becky Sharp and Ravenwood. Though I believe it actually came out significantly before Ravenwood. It significantly expands on that and also on your use and adaption of the Twin Peaks mythology. Could you give us a refresher on what this mythology is and how you use it?
Well, the mythology goes back to a notion, an Eastern notion that I learned of through Twin Peaks, known as the Black Lodge and the White Lodge, and then the Dugpas. I believe they are actually, as I've researched it, red caps, yellow caps. These things that I thought were fiction. Coming through Talbot Mundy's writing in his great book, The Devil's Guard. I highly recommend that book. He was a great writer in terms of being able to put you in a place, you know. And he gets into that. And apparently someone on the Twin Peaks cast was familiar with it because one of the villains in Twin Peaks has a line that's almost an exact quotation from the Talbot Mundy book. Behind that was theosophy. But behind theosophy, I believe these notions, at least of Dugpas, are something that's based in the real world. They first appear in the 14th century, and they basically, the word I understand means wizard or sorcerer. And, you know, there would seem to be a connection between them and particularly the Black Lodge. So that's where I learned of that. What I wondered about in watching Twin Peaks was, you know, how did this information get from India, you know, to existing among the Native Americans in the Pacific, Northwest? How did that happen? And so I didn't really get into this in the Frequency of Fear itself, but it was in my head that basically, you know, they brought it over the land bridge with them. When the precursors to modern Native Americans, crossed over way back when, they brought this knowledge with them and this belief with them. In my story, they end up in what's now Florida, and they the idea from Twin Peaks was that the Black Lodge entities fed off of pain and suffering. That was their food, and of course in Lynch's stuff, it comes out in the form of cream corn. Which is really kind of odd.
I mean, what else would pain and suffering and fear look like?
Well, that's true. Cream corn is pretty scary. But what I did in my story was to actually, I wanted to do a homage to the monster subgenre of evil plants. And so in my story, what happens is that a piece of a planet that there was once in space a planet of plants that fed on fear, and because as plant life and not animal life, they couldn't generate it, and there were bovine type alien creatures that they could inspire fear and pain out of, and they fed off of it, but they had to have animals to do it. Then the planet exploded, and a good sized chunk of it hit in Florida where the Dugpas were, and there, and here I was taking a page from both Lovecraft's The Color Out of Space and also the Philip Jose Farmer extension of Iron Castle. Which was that, the alien plant life there, that what was with that in that meteorite, begins to terraform the Indian reservation. And so sentient plants that feed on fear begin to emerge there. And the local Native American population develops a relationship with them. And the plants actually work with them. I mean, I did some studying into plants, man. I thought I would, but found out that there are plants that mimic the appearance or the smell of bad-tasting plants so that animals won't eat them. And like, there's some plants that they start secreting a smell or something that will draw bees, you know, to basically like stinging you, so you lay off the plant. And just wild, you know, wild stuff like that. But with mine, you know, in my story, they're using it. So they're like the plants that are mimicking bad-tasting plants. They will circle the Native American gardens on the reservation, you know, to keep the animals away. And but, of course, there is a price. And there are plants and feeding on fear. The lesser ones can do with things like a bird being scared to death or whatever. But the others demand human fear. And so to keep that relationship going deep in the woods of the Indian reservation, where the meteorite was landed, there's some very tall ancient trees. And the Dugpus participate in the rituals of dealing, you know, summoning from within unfortunate individuals, their pain and sorrow, to feed the trees, among other things. But of course, they're Dugpus, so they're, you know, adept at it. So,
yes.
So that's kind of the basic backstory to that. So there's
And one last question before we close for this episode: where can our readers find the story?
The Frequency of Fear is available on Amazon for as a Kindle only for a mere 99 cents.
And really, at that price, you can't afford not to read it.
No. And there are lots of monster tie-overs. You know, like I say, I don't just tie over plants, but other movie and literary references to people who have dealt in fear, that have dealt with fear. For example, there's an old Boris Karloff movie called The Fear Chamber. And so that's actually, you know, ties in with my story as well. It's a different kind of tale, I think. And basically what leads into it is a Frenchman from their equivalent of the Secret Service or spies has come looking for someone, a criminal, who is an expert in gaslighting people and scaring them to death, who has slipped free.
Noir. Join us next week as the MH Squad reunites. Oh yeah, I guess we're also going to have that guy with the obnoxiously hard to pronounce last name. Yeah, he'll be there too. But it's the MH Squad, the more important part. As we wrap up this week, we want to remind you all about a very, very important crossover event that's going to be on TV. For you guys, it will have started last night. For us, it's still a couple days off. But the Arrowverse four-part crossover featuring Supergirl, Flash, The Arrow, and Legends of Tomorrow are all going to join up for a giant four-night event that I've been looking forward to for months. So make sure you listen.
And we want to thank our sponsor, accidentally bumping the mute button on your microphone, which leads to awkward, long pauses. Think of it as a chance to memorize our theme song. A special thanks to Robert Ronsky Jr. for starting us on this journey, as well as the Tiny White and the Deadites for our show's theme, Leaf on a Stream. Thanks to all listen, you make this possible. Remember to subscribe and rate our show on iTunes. It makes all the difference. And as always, everything happens somewhere, even when your mic is muted. Good night.
See you next time.